Welcome to Lectionary at Lunch. I'm Dr. David Adams, and this week we will be examining, as our Old Testament lesson, the very famous passage from the book of the prophet Isaiah, chapter 7, verses 10 to 14. In this passage, God declares that he will give Judah a sign of their coming deliverance in a child to be born and called Emmanuel, God with us. Before we get into the text, it may be helpful to establish some historical context. By the middle of the 8th century, the growing power of Assyria was a looming threat on the northeastern border of all the small kingdoms and city-states along the eastern Mediterranean, including Judah, ruled over by the descendants of King David in Jerusalem, and Israel to its north, called Samaria, after the name of its capital city. All of the small nations of this region were torn between their fear of the power of Egypt to the south and their fear of the growing power of Assyria to their north. Some of them, Samaria and Damascus in particular, tried to form an alliance to resist the growing Assyrian power and the threat of an Assyrian invasion. Judah's leaders preferred to pay tribute to Assyria and exist in peace as a vassal state of that great power. In a conflict known today as the Syro-Ephraimite War, the kings of Samaria and Damascus attempted to force Judah to join their alliance. Isaiah records the reaction to these events, beginning at the start of chapter 7. When the house of David was told, "Syria is in league with Ephraim," the heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as trees of the forest shake before the wind. It is in this climate of fear and uncertainty for the future that God sent his prophet Isaiah to the royal court in Jerusalem with this message. We turn now to Isaiah chapter 7, verse 10. Vayosef hayadaber el Ahaz lemor. Then Yahweh spoke again to Ahaz. The passage begins with God speaking through the prophet. The editors of BHS propose reading Isaiah instead of Yahweh as the subject here, but there's no real support for that suggestion. The sentence begins with the combination of verbs Vayosef and daber. This is an example of the standard Hebrew usage of two verbs to communicate a single idea, what grammarians call hindiadys. The verb yasaf, meaning to add, used with another verb, forming the idiom to add to do something, is a way of saying to do something again. In this case, yasaf is joined with the verb dabar, to speak, and so the idiom means to speak again. Verse 11. Sha'al lakaoth me'im Yahweh Elohecha. Ask for a sign from Yahweh your God. Here we have the preposition lamed with a second person masculine suffix following the imperative sha'al, ask. One might be tempted to translate ask for yourself. That would be quite a literal translation, but it neglects the idiomatic use of Hebrew. This use of laka following an imperative is quite common. It's often referred to as an ethical dative, and it probably represents a slightly fuller way of expressing the imperative idea. In some cases, this appears to be a slightly more emphatic form, and you might perhaps make that argument here. But most of the time, it's simply an alternative way of expressing the imperative. And so we translate simply, ask. Similarly, we have an example of the use of the compound preposition me'im from with, instead of the simple preposition min from by itself. Hebrew likes these kinds of compounds. We have many other examples like from above and from below and from before and so on. And Hebrew uses them frequently as an alternative way of expressing the idea of spatial relationships. Most of the time in English, it's best simply to translate these as from, unless the added specificity is necessary to clarify what's being said in the context. The verse continues, make it as deep as Sheol, or make it as high as what is above. This clause is slightly problematic in that it seems clumsy to English readers, but it's really perfectly good Hebrew. It begins with a hipial imperative from the verb amak, or amake, to be deep. The next phrase has a similar form, the hipial imperative hagbeah, from gaba, to be high. The hipial of these verbs convey the sense of causing or making something high or deep, and apparently in this case refers to the request. This leads us to the next word, which really is problematic, although only slightly so. The Masoretic text reads sha'ala, apparently meaning the request. Make the request deep. There are two problems here. First, this is not a proper form. As it stands, it must be understood as either an unknown word, presumably a noun, or as an alternative pointing of a longer form of the pl infinitive of the verb sha'al, meaning something like the asking. But this form of the word would normally be sha'ela, not sha'ala. The second problem is that while the phrase does make sense as it stands, it does not balance very well with the next phrase, which refers to mala, that which is above. The Septuagint translates sha'ala as hadain, Hades, the underworld. These factors combined have led most commentators and translators to the conclusion that the Masoretic text is mispointed here, and that we should read sha'ola instead of sha'ala. This repointing would give us the word sha'ol, the Hebrew word for the underground, which fits better with both the Septuagint's reading of Hades and the parallelism of the next phrase. Verse 12. Vayomer Ahaz lo eshal walo nase eth Yahweh. Then Ahaz said, I will not ask, for I will not put Yahweh to the test. There are no real problems here with either the text or the translation. I have taken the wow, introducing the second clause, to be the introduction of an epexegetical or explanatory clause. For other examples of the conjunction wow used that way, consult the lexicon or check one of the reference grammars, such as Gazanius, at paragraph 158a. Commentators disagree over whether King Ahaz was sincere in his hesitation to put God to the test, or whether he was just using that as a convenient excuse to disregard the prophet's message. And most commentators probably take it the latter way. Clearly, putting God to the test is regarded as presumptuous and sinful in both the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 6:16, for example, and in the New Testament, for Jesus himself cites this passage in Matthew chapter 4, verse 7, and Luke chapter 4, verse 12. Some commentators point to God's critique of Ahaz's position in the following verses as evidence of Ahaz's insincerity. But God does not question the king's sincerity in these verses. He calls the king to account for his unwillingness to obey God's command through the prophet. So in the end, the question of Ahaz's sincerity matters very little. What matters in God's sight is his disobedience, whatever the cause. Verse 13. Vayomer Shimuna Beth David Hamaat makim haloth anashim ki talu gam eth Elohai. Then he said, "Listen, O house of David, is it too little a thing for you to make men weary, that you must also make my God weary?" The first question to be answered here is, who is speaking? From the context, it's clear that there has been a change of subject, and so Ahaz is no longer the subject of the verb. The alternatives are Yahweh, who was the previous speaker, or the prophet Isaiah. The content, which speaks of God in the third person, makes us lean toward Isaiah as the speaker here. The editors of BHS attempt to clarify this by suggesting that we read the verb, Vayomer, as a first-person verb, Vayomer, then I said, rather than the third person, then he said. But this is hardly necessary. The form of the imperative that follows, Shim'una, with the particle na attached to the imperative form, suggests that Isaiah is here employing a more respectful tone toward the king. He confronts the king for his disobedience, but not in an in-your-face kind of way. He remains respectful of the God-given position of the heir of David. This is also reflected in the title that he uses to address the king, calling him the House of David. The next clause is introduced with a hey interrogative attached to the noun ma'at. Ma'at means a little thing or a trifle. The verb la'a, to be weary in the call, occurs twice here, both times in the hifil, each time with a causative sense. The first is an infinitive construct. The second person is a second person masculine plural imperfect. The use of the plural when speaking to the king again suggests a sign of respect. In this case, what grammarians sometimes call the plural of majesty. Verse 14. This is, of course, the most famous verse in this pericope. It presents several interesting features, so we'll take it clause by clause. Lakein yetein Adonai hu lakim oath. Therefore, my Lord himself will give you a sign. Here we have the title Adonai, my Lord, rather than the divine name Yahweh. This usage is not common in the Old Testament, but it's certainly not unknown either. It occurs especially in discourse, that is, when people are talking to one another. And this usage, here and elsewhere, is the basis of the later tendency for translators to substitute Lord for Yahweh wherever the name of God occurs. The verse continues, Hine ha'alma hara v'yoledeth bein. Behold, the girl, or perhaps better, this girl, is pregnant and about to bear a son. The challenge here is how to translate the Hebrew term Alma. Hebrew linguists are virtually unanimous in their agreement that this term and its related terms in other languages are commonly used of any young female who is past puberty and thus sexually mature. Because the predominant connotation of the term is of one who is young and vigorous, the term is used as a common one for young adult females. In some cases, as in Joel chapter 2, verse 16, and Proverbs chapter 30, verse 19, these females are married and thus presumably sexually active. In other contexts, there is a clear emphasis on virginity, as when the Alma of Genesis chapter 24, verse 43, is described a few verses earlier in verse 16 as one who has never been with a man. The use of the term here to speak about one who is already pregnant, the adjective hara clearly indicates this, and it's reinforced further by the phrase "Wayoledeth bain," suggests that the Alma in this case is a young woman who is sexually active and probably married, but has not yet given birth to her first child. The problem for the translator arises from the fact that English has no exact equivalent term for this category. But the matter is complicated by theological concerns. The Septuagint translates Alma with the Greek word parthenos, which normally, but not exclusively, implies a young female, though occasionally the term parthenos is also used of men, as in Revelation 14, verse 4. It typically signifies one who is past puberty but who has never had sexual intercourse, a virgin. Matthew uses this same word of Mary in chapter 1 of his gospel, and further clarifies the point by stating that Mary had no sexual relations with her espoused husband before the birth of Jesus. He also then cites our verse, Isaiah 7:14, noting that the virgin birth of Jesus was the fulfillment of this prophecy. Later Greek translators, Aquila, Symmachus, and Theodotion, all translate Alma with the Greek term neanis, which is used more often in the general sense of a young woman lacking the virginal connotations of parthenos. Most commentators believe that this translational choice on the part of Aquila, Symmachus, and Theodotion represents Jewish resistance to the Christian claims that this verse predicts the coming Messiah. Although that may not be true, because Justin Martyr, who's clearly a Christian, uses the same term, neanis, when he quotes and refers to this verse in his dialogue with Trypho. It is inevitable that over the last several centuries, this verse, Isaiah 7:14, has become something of a test case for the interpretation of messianic prophecy. Those who want to deny the possibility of predictive prophecy have advanced the view that the woman referred to here is not Mary, but some woman living at the time of Ahaz and Isaiah, although the exact identity of that woman is much debated. Unfortunately, many of those who wish to defend the possibility of predictive prophecy have felt that it was necessary to take an exact opposite position and say that the woman referred to here is Mary and no one else. That position is difficult to maintain, since it makes nonsense of the idea that God is giving a sign to Ahaz through Isaiah. The appropriate way to understand this verse is to see the child who is about to be born as a type of the coming Messiah, a prophecy in the form of a person rather than in words alone. It points both to an event on the immediate horizon of the prophet's experience, a true sign to Ahaz and to Judah at the time of Isaiah, and at the same time, it points beyond them to the one who will not merely be Emmanuel as a symbol of God's presence with his people, but who will be Emmanuel fulfilled, God present in the flesh, not merely as a symbol. Since typological prophecy commonly involves increasing specificity, it's entirely within the realm of typological prophecy that an Alma, in the general sense of a young woman who is married and pregnant at the time of Isaiah, could foreshadow an Alma in a more specific sense, of a young woman who is a betrothed virgin, who will bear a son who is not merely David's heir, but the fulfillment of all that King David foreshadows. To carry on with the verse, "V'karath shemo Immanuel, and you shall call his name Emmanuel." The grammatical problem here is how to take the verb karath. As it stands, it appears to be a call while consecutive perfect second feminine singular from the root kara, or call. That is how both the Septuagint and the Vulgate take it. However, some Septuagintal manuscripts read the third-person feminine form, and Gazanius, in his grammar in paragraph 74g, attempts to defend this as a third feminine singular form. He says it's formed by analogy with third he forms, despite the fact that the same form appears in Genesis chapter 16:11 in a context that absolutely requires a second person form. Most commentators and translators follow Gazanius's lead and translate, "She shall call his name Emmanuel," which makes sense in the context on the assumption that the prophet is still speaking to Ahaz. If, however, we understand the form to be a second-person form, then we would take it that the prophet has turned and is not speaking to Ahaz, but is speaking to the woman herself at this point when he says, "You shall call his name Emmanuel." The name Emmanuel is a compound of several parts. The first part, im, is the preposition meaning with. The second part, anu, is the object of the preposition, meaning us. The third part, el, is the short form of the common noun God. Immanuel, God is with us. Before we wrap up, we should add a few observations about preaching this text. In the oracle that Isaiah delivers to King Ahaz, God promises to provide a sign of his coming deliverance. A child who is about to be born will be named Emmanuel, God with us. God had, of course, been with his people from the time that they had been delivered from Egypt in the Exodus, some 700 years before the time of Ahaz and Isaiah. God had led them by a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. He had dwelled among them, first in the tabernacle and later in the temple. So the fact of God's presence with Israel was not a new thing. What is promised here is that God who is with them is also God who is for them, who will act on their behalf and deliver them from the destruction of the city and the death of the people at the hands of their enemies. The child born as a sign to Ahaz and the people of Judah foreshadowed the birth of another child, a second Emmanuel, some 700 years later. This second Emmanuel would not be merely a symbol of God's presence with his people, but is God in the flesh, God become man. Like the child of Ahaz's day, this second Emmanuel will deliver the people of God. But unlike the Emmanuel of Ahaz's day, this second Emmanuel would not deliver the people of Judah only, but all mankind, and not merely from the destruction of their city and their physical death at the hands of their enemies, but deliver them from eternal death and utter destruction in the fires of hell. Jesus is the second Emmanuel. He is true God become man to deliver man to God. We celebrate the birth of this second Emmanuel at Christmas time, because he is not only a sign that we will be delivered. He is in his flesh and in his death and in his resurrection. He is our deliverance. I'm Dr. David Adams, thanking you for joining us for this week's lectionary at lunch, as we have examined Isaiah chapter 7, verses 10 to 14.